Space, time, and matter.
The mysterious forces of nature.
What is gravity?
All the symbols representing all the elements around us.
Bright minds known as theoretical physicists.
Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
We have something a little bit different for you this evening. Because of popular demand, showing how well we listen to our loyal constituents, we have decided to have an audience night. This came from a specific suggestion from several of you, and specifically from Doug Gill of Oakville, who said it would be great if we had an opportunity to have questions from the audience about a whole spectrum of issues in theoretical physics and have them addressed by researchers at Perimeter. And that's, in fact, exactly what we've done. We've done things a little bit differently here. We asked for your questions ahead of time, as you know, by email or by phone, and there was quite a large number of people who responded. We didn't have the opportunity to answer all of your questions, and we tried to select the questions that we thought would be of the widest possible interest to everybody here. The first question involves space-time and the discreteness of space-time. It will be asked by Gord Rice of London, Ontario, and it will be answered by Thomas Thiemann, the gentleman to my immediate left here, who is a long-term researcher at Perimeter, and he's also with Max Planck Institute in Gulm, Germany. And Thomas is an expert in quantum gravity, and this question pertains to the discreteness of space-time. So, Mr. Rice.
Thank you. Currently, discrete theories of space-time are being explored in fundamental physics. Can one derive Heisenberg's uncertainty principle from them? Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you for the question. And I should say from the beginning that this is a very good and a very deep question. And I'm not going to be able to answer it in much detail, but I will try. So let me repeat the question. Is there a way to derive Heisenberg's uncertainty principle from fundamental theories of discrete theories of space-time? And I will start by trying to explain these terms and then tell you what a kind of conclusion is. So, to begin with, there's in physics today, physics today is based on two fundamental principles. There's quantum theory. There's one column in this temple here, and there's relativity. And there are very bizarre properties of this, both of these theories, and when you put these properties together, you become to even more bizarre properties, and I will try to point some of them out. Let me begin with quantum theory, and let me start off with something that many of you have done, namely to make measurements of some certain kind. So let the letter x stands for position of a particle, say, or maybe if you want to think in more practical terms, it could be the position of anything like a baseball, for example. P is the momentum of the particle, or if you don't know what is a momentum, think of a baseball thrown at you and you catch it. The strength with which you have to catch the baseball is proportional to the momentum of the ball. Then you set up an experiment, and what you do is you actually measure, so say you shoot 50 baseballs against the wall and you note where the ball hits the wall and with which strength it hits the wall. And you note down these numbers, you get 50 numbers for x, you get 50 numbers for p, and then you compute the average. So where on average has this ball hit the wall, and with which strength it has done that. And you can also compute the deviation, or the average deviation of the position in any given of these experiments from the average position. And the same for the momentum. And then we can formulate Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. No matter how fine your measuring apparatus is, you can never beat the Heisenberg uncertainty bound. And here we introduce the first fundamental constant in physics, namely Planck's constant. So what this equation says is that the measurement error that you are doing in x position, the measurement error times the measurement error in the momentum, has to be always bigger than h bar, Planck's constant. So in particular, none of these numbers can ever be zero. There's a different way of saying this, namely, or a consequence of this is that the mathematical notion of a point particle is actually only an abstraction. Physically, particles always have a spatial extension. And if you think of a particle of momentum p, then the extension of this particle has to be at least of this order, h bar divided by p. And I want to point out here one particular feature, namely, quantum mechanics by itself allows that p becomes arbitrarily large. So this, the measurement uncertainty in x can be arbitrarily small. You just have to make the particle very, very fast. And one way where this is used is, for example, in things like electron microscopes, where people, for example, study things in solid state physics, like or in biology, where you study cells, where you can use highly energetic or fast electrons in order to resolve these structures in cells and solids, other things. Now let's switch to the second column in my in this temple of physics that we are talking about. So we have special and we have general relativity, and my colleagues will explain more features of both of these theories. So, but for my purposes, just enough to point out two important equations. So this is a very famous equation. I'm sure that everybody has seen this before in his life. Einstein's famous E equals mc squared formula, which says that if you have a highly energetic or very fast particle, then the mass of that particle increases. That's just one feature of special relativity, and I'm not going to explain this. I'm just taking it as given. Another feature now of general relativity is given by the following fact. If you squeeze a lump of energy, let's say a particle moving with certain velocity, with a certain momentum, if you squeeze such a particle in a box of an extension, of a spatial extension which is small enough, smaller than this this number here, which is called the Schwarzschild radius, then this particle will become a black hole. So let me explain this formula. Here we see two more fundamental constants of nature. This is so-called Newton's constant, and this is the speed of light. This Newton's constant is something that tells you how strong gravity is, and the speed of light, well, is a fundamental speed that photons have in vacuum. And this number is a number that determines when certain massive bodies collapse to black holes. Say the sun, for example, which has something like 2 to the 33 kilograms, the Schwarzschild radius would be 1 kilometer, and the sun is something like 10 to the 6, like 1 million kilometers in radius, so the Schwarzschild radius is much, much smaller than the extension of the sun, so it's not going to collapse. It's not a black hole. But the black hole is a very strange thing, because it's, for example, one of its features is that no information can escape from such an object. Now let's put these things together, and we get to the topic of the question. So we have seen two formulas. We have seen the spatial extension of a particle, and we saw that it's, you can make it smaller by increasing the velocity of the particle or by increasing its energy. On the other hand, we have seen that the Schwarzschild radius becomes bigger when you increase the energy. So you see that at some point, this number on the top becomes smaller than this number, and at this point, you will have gravitational collapse. So the particle becomes a black hole. On the other hand, again, we can use Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and in this case, it tells us that such black hole has only a very short lifetime. It evaporates in 10 to the minus 43 seconds. And what this means physically is the following. It's in principle impossible to build a microscope with a better resolution, with a better spatial resolution than the Planck length, which is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. By the way, you see here how the fundamental constants of nature are combined in a single number. This is the so-called Planck length. So in other words, space-time, if you put these things together, becomes something like a structure which you are familiar with from, well, it's like saying that there's atoms of geometry or atoms of space and time, and these atoms have an extension of the Planck length or the Planck time. So just for your amusement, there's, of course, popular pictures about this. So here we are at the atomic scale, 10 to the minus 12 centimeters. That's the scale at which electrons are orbiting around nuclei in atoms. Then you can go down a little bit, and you will see that what you thought was a smooth and nice space-time becomes a little bit curvy already. And then when you go to the Planck length, you get to a chaotic picture. And I will close with this transparency, which is actually a still from a computer animated calculation in a particular theory of quantum gravity, which is called loop quantum gravity. And what you see here are excitations of space and time, and the strengths of these excitations are illustrated by the colors in this picture. So thank you.
We're going to move on to a completely different question now, and this one will be presented to us by Neil Eaton.
Physicist Serfana presenting Schrodinger's cat to lay audiences. At the end of the lecture, we're usually left with the impression that the cat is in a quantum superposition of two states until we open the lid. I don't understand how the human can collapse the wave function by opening the lid, but the cat can't do it all by itself. Surely humans aren't in a unique position as observers in quantum mechanics. What am I missing?
Okay. Thank you, Neil. This is a great question. Actually, it's a question is very similar to that prompted me during my undergrad studies in physics to want to understand the foundations of quantum mechanics more deeply, so I can make sense of these paradoxes, one of which is the one you've brought up. To bring everybody up to speed in the audience, I'm going to review some of the elements of Neil's question before turning to some attempt at an answer. All right, so quantum theory is a theory describing our fundamental particles, non-relativistically, and it has many unusual features, which very much startled the founders who developed the theory. One of the most striking features is the fact that when we try to describe how elementary particles evolve in time and space, we find that the equation needed for that is a wave equation. In the case of quantum mechanics, it's called the Schrodinger wave equation, and that the properties of the particles are described by a wave function. Now, these wave equations to wave functions are entirely analogous to the waves that you think about when you think about water waves or acoustic waves, and very different from the notion of deterministic particle trajectories that you learn about in, Newtonian description of how particles evolve, like baseballs and cannonballs and so on. Another feature of quantum mechanics is that the whenever there's a measurement of a system, when we try and learn about the system, we necessarily disturb it. So this is captured by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which you've heard about from Thomas a moment ago. A third property, which is less relevant for our discussion, is that generally, quantum mechanics only allows probabilistic prediction. So it doesn't say exactly what's going to happen when you make a measurement, but what the probabilities are of getting different outcomes. So the very important feature for Neil's question is this notion of coherent superpositions. So this is something that's a little bit tricky to explain, so I'll do the best I can. Basically, a coherent superposition is a notion introduced by quantum mechanics that can be described in analogy to the following. Consider two position states of a particle. The particle can be up or down, where these are just regions of space. A coherent superposition state, which I'll denote just up plus down, means that, of course, you'll sometimes find the particle to be up, and with some other probability, find the particle to be down. But the key, I mean, that's not surprising. What's surprising is that this particular state, this coherent superposition state, has measurably different properties from just the classical notion of the particle being either up or down. So what does that mean exactly? Well, let me list some of the properties first. We know that when a particle is in one of these coherent superposition states, it means that it can produce an interference pattern under certain conditions. And that's a well-known wave-like phenomena. Anton Zeilinger was here for one of the public lectures, I think 2 months ago, and described how these interference effects, which we understood from the point of view of elementary particles, can be observed in the lab for much larger systems, including macromolecules. He used carbon-60 and carbon-72 buckyballs. So this is a well-verified phenomenon. And another example of coherent superpositions arises in the case of quantum computation. In fact, they're essential for the advantages of quantum information and quantum computation. Those of you who saw Ray Laflamme's lecture here about 3 months ago would have heard a bit more about quantum communication and computation and how these coherent superposition states can be created in the lab in prototype quantum computers, like in nuclear magnetic resonance devices. So there's no doubt about the fact that these things empirically exist, but the question is, what do they mean? So what are they really like? What's going on? How can we interpret them? And that is actually a fundamental question of interpretation of quantum mechanics. How do we make sense of these states? So one common conception, which some of you may have heard, is that when a particle is in one of these coherent superposition states, that means that it's really in the two places at once, which is a very unfamiliar notion from our regular everyday experience. But we can think of this as a kind of blurred reality for microscopic particles. But if we take that tact, and you don't have to go down this path, by the way, but if you do, and many physicists do, you encounter some problems. The first problem was brought out by Neil, which is the Schrodinger's cat experiment. So all the way back in 1935, Schrodinger, who, of course, developed the fundamental wave equation of quantum mechanics, pointed out a difficulty. He said, well, okay, maybe we're comfortable with the idea of a blurred reality at the microscopic level. But it turns out that if we analyze the problem carefully, we realize that that blurred reality can be extended all the way to the macroscopic level. So the example he used to draw this out, here I've quoted and paraphrased from his article in 1935, is we can even imagine quite ridiculous cases. So imagine a cat in a sealed box with a small mechanism which releases hydrocyanic acid only on the condition of one of two equally probable atomic states. And those atomic states are initially prepared in a coherent superposition. And then he points out that the wave function of the entire system would express this by having in it the living and the dead cat. I don't really know why he says pardon the expression there, but having in it the living and the dead cat mixed or smeared out in equal parts. So this is unusual, to say the least. Here we have a pictorial representation of what Schrodinger had in mind. So we have a box with an observer. We imagine here an alpha decay event, which has equal probability of decaying or not decaying. If it decays, then the alpha particle strikes a Geiger counter, which then releases a hammer striking the acid and the poor cat dies. If it doesn't decay, then the cat stays alive. Now for the young people in the audience, I want you to be assured that There were no actual animals harmed in the course of this thought experiment. Now, a second problem related to this, this idea of a blurred reality, is that when we actually do make observations and assess what outcome we observed, we realize that we just get a distinct outcome. We either find the cat to be alive or we find it to be dead. We either find the particle up or we find it to be down. So where did the blurriness go? So John von Neumann realized this problem when he was writing the first very systematic axiomatization of quantum theory in 1932 in his seminal textbook. And there he found it necessary to postulate there must be some discontinuous collapse of the wave function to really make quantum mechanics consistent with our experience. And this should occur whenever a measurement takes place. And then when he was describing his conclusion, I've highlighted in blue the important part, we have then answered the question as to what happens in the measurement of an observable to be sure the how remains unexplained for the present. This discontinuous transition from the wave function into one of the observable states is certainly not of the type described by the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. So it's a violation of Schrodinger's equation, and the question is when and under what conditions should we not use Schrodinger's equation and use this discontinuous collapse instead? So that's led to a lot of speculation and confused me, as certainly when I was learning quantum mechanics, and it's been troubling Neil as well, I see. And now we've arrived at tonight's question. How can it be that a human act of observation can produce a change in the state of the cat? So John Bell, one of the great physicists of this century, he demonstrated the necessity of non-locality for entangled quantum states, as an aside. He asked this question as well. And he really wanted to point out how absurd the idea was, and so put it thus. What exactly qualifies some physical system to play the role of measurer? Was it the wave function? Was the wave function of the world waiting to jump for thousands of millions of years until a single-celled living creature appeared? Or did it have to wait a while longer for some better qualified system with a PhD? So some physicists actually do believe this, I think. So Einstein threw in his opinion quite strongly on this matter. This is the year of Einstein, incidentally, as many of you know. And for him, this notion of blurred quantum states, this notion of collapse, these are all really consequences of making a false assumption right from the start. Did quantum states give us a complete description of reality? So he, to quote Einstein directly, one arrives at very implausible theoretical conceptions if one attempts to maintain the thesis that the statistical quantum theory is in principle capable of producing a complete description of an individual physical system. I'm convinced that everyone who will take the trouble to carry through such reflections conscientiously will find himself finally driven to the view that the wave function is not to be understood as the complete description of a single system. It appears unavoidable to look elsewhere for a complete description of the individual system. I'm rather firmly convinced that the development of theoretical physics will be of that type, but the path will be lengthy and difficult. So, needless to say, we don't have the answer yet. In fact, trying to understand this problem and analyze it is an area of active research at the Perimeter Institute and around the world. Let me just point out in conclusion two of the contemporary approaches which can give partial answers to the question. So one is the many worlds interpretation, and this is that the different properties in coherent superpositions are not a blurring of our reality, but correspond to parallel realities or parallel worlds. So there's a world in which the cat is found dead, so I'm correlated with that world if I find the cat dead. And in another world, I find the cat alive. And these are equally valid realities. So this is a fantastic interpretation of the quantum mechanical problems, which I personally don't espouse to and don't recommend you do either. I prefer to follow in the path of Einstein, and that is to take the view that quantum states they're called statistical or informational or epistemic interpretation. And that is that the blurriness associated with coherent superpositions is not a blurriness of reality, but a blurriness of our knowledge of reality. That sounds reasonable enough, but you have to realize there's a price you have to pay if you take that point of view. First of all, then how do we account for the wave-like interference effects that are observed in double-slit experiments? And there are other technical constraints concerned with non-locality and contextuality, which I don't have the time to get into. But these are constraints on any kind of hidden variables that we assume really give a full description of the system. And so there are problems there that haven't been resolved to everyone's satisfaction. But those are at least two approaches for dealing with that question. I hope that was somewhat helpful.
So thank you very much, Joseph, for that very enlightening and clever detailed explanation while shamelessly appealing to authority and at the same time not answering the question. Without any further ado, let me give the name of the questioner, who is Doug de la Mater, and I should add that Doug has come all the way here from Barry's Bay, and those of you who know that that's 2 hours north of Ottawa, and because of that, we are willing to give Mr. de la Mater a little bit of leeway, and he will have the opportunity to read a two-part question. And of course, Raphael at this point only has 45 seconds to answer it.
I'll try and read the second part at the speed of light, so we'll be won't worry about that. The first part actually is what we should deal with, I suppose. In special relativity, we always see things approaching the speed of light. My question is, what does the universe look like to a photon traveling at the speed of light? In special relativity, a rapidly moving observer sees objects shrink in size and clocks slow down. So to a photon moving at the speed of light, would our clocks appear to have stopped? And would the universe appear to shrink to a sheet of paper with zero thickness? Putting these together, as my editor did, does light exist in a universe where time is stopped and there's no place to go? And therefore, when we consider a photon of light, are we dealing with a sort of frozen energy that has not changed since the Big Bang?
Right. We have all learned a lot from thinking about these questions, as in fact Howard predicted in a newspaper article earlier in the week. The second thing I want to say is that the question is actually ambiguous. It can be taken in two ways. Now I'm looking to see if Howard cringes because he doesn't like the word ambiguous. But it's actually not something bad. In fact, it's impossible to formulate a question which is not ambiguous unless you thoroughly know the answer in advance. For example, if you're making up a final exam question. And many of you in the audience, I'm sure, can testify that even that is not enough, especially if you've taken a final exam recently. So the ambiguity here is the meaning of what does the photon see? Does it mean if we were to move almost at the speed of light, which is because we can't go quite at the speed of light, what would we actually experience and perceive just as normal observers? Or does it mean what would we deduce by making use of a reference frame? Now, when you read textbook descriptions of special relativity, what you usually find being talked about is a reference frame. When you read that clocks, moving clocks slow down, or moving rulers shorten, this is not what you would see, but a description in a reference frame. So I want to start by describing a little bit what actually is the kind of reference frame that people talk about in relativity. And also, I've tried to give you here a reference frame for my own talk. And so we're talking now about reference frame versus observer. And then having done that, I want to try and answer the question on that basis and then draw out maybe what is one of the deeper implications of the question in my mind. So what is a reference frame? Right, so there's a reference frame. What you're supposed to look at here is not the Taj Mahal, but the scaffolding around it. This would be the kind of thing that you would have to construct if you were to produce a reference frame. In fact, I happened to look at the 1905 paper by Einstein that we're all celebrating this year, in which he introduced special relativity. And he actually doesn't mention observers at all, as far as I can see, or only rarely. What he talks about is reference frames, or as he calls them, coordinate systems, things that assign numbers to events. And when he talks about coordinate systems, he doesn't mean imaginary axes that you draw in space-time where it lines on a graph, he means something nuts and bolts, something very, very physical, something made of, as he said, rigid bodies and clocks and maybe a little sealing wax and duct tape thrown in to hold it all together. So that's the kind of thing you'd have to do. But the Taj Mahal may be a little distracting, so let me give you something where you can focus more on the reference frame. If you could imagine this extending out forever in all directions, and moreover, it looks complicated enough, but if you provided it with a large number of clocks, say one every place two rods cross, you put a clock, and then at that place you also station an observer provided with a notepad, and he or she is taking down furiously information on all the events they see at that point, what their clock read, and what happened. That's actually a reference frame. Furthermore, they have to synchronize their clocks, say, by passing light signals back and forth. Now, when someone says that a moving clock slows down, they're actually talking about something like that. What they mean is a moving clock comes through the reference frame. Each observer locally notes down when the clock on his or her clock passed by and what the moving clock said. The next observer does the same thing. Then they all compare notes, and they find that time passed more slowly in the moving clock than in their own reference frame. But this is very, very different from what you would actually see if you were to observe a moving clock with your own eyes. In fact, in some ways, it can be exactly the opposite. A clock approaching you would not appear to slow down. It would appear to speed up. And a ruler approaching you would not appear to get shorter. It appears to get longer. On the other hand, the clock receding from you appears to slow down all right, but by much more than the textbook amount, and so on. So just to give you an idea of the dramatic difference, there's a movie here of what you would see, if I can make this work. This is what you would see if you could go at very high speed along a desert road. Or if the speed of light were much slower than it was and you were going along a desert road. The thing to watch here is the building on the right. You'll see that although it seems to get longer at some point and to rotate and get distorted, at no point does it get very short or look like the kind of piece of paper that was mentioned in the question. So you can see it actually seems to recede at first, although you're getting closer to it. This is the lengthening of things that are coming towards you. Don't blame me for the music. Now you can see it sort of rotating and stretching. There's some interesting effects in the sky that there's no time to talk about. And now you're more or less past it. In fact, you've been past it for a while. So I think you can see from that you don't see it like a piece of paper. So with this in mind, with this difference between the reference frame and the observer in mind, what does the photon actually see? A photon, say, emitted in the Big Bang, I think it was, and now just received by one of us. Well, we can't actually imagine being the photon because no material object can move quite at the speed of light. But let's suppose that we were going at near the speed of light, say 0.9999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999 if I had said 56 nines like that, then the whole, according to the, if you believed in the Lorentz contraction, the whole visible universe would be shrunk down to 1 centimeter. And that would mean that you would see the whole history of the universe in a flash, like people say that a dying person or a drowning person sees. You would see the Big Bang, you would see the chemical elements form, you would see galaxies condensing out of the gas, you would see the stars turn on, you would see life begin. Well, from there it's all downhill, so I'll quit. The important thing is that the universe would not, so this is the second, well, I've talked about rigid bodies and clocks, there's the numbers, so the important to such an observer, the universe would not look frozen as a sheet of paper. It would look something like what we just saw in the video. And it, you would see an enormous number of things happening very rapidly. You might also ask, what would the photon, quote unquote, see if it enlisted the help of a reference system moving with that same 0.99999? That's a complicated question, and I don't want to answer it here because I'd rather take the time to get to what seems to me the real deep point of the question, which is the photon that reaches us from the Big Bang in some sense unchanged since the Big Bang? Is it bringing us direct information from the Big Bang, something like a fossil? In my opinion, the answer is yes, and it has a very profound, that yes has a very profound meaning. So let's not, for illustration, talk about the Big Bang, because for one thing, no photon could have survived since the Big Bang. For a more important reason, to talk about the Big Bang properly, you need general relativity, because space-time is very curved around the Big Bang. Instead of that, let's talk about something closer to home, like a star 100 light years away from here. Does the light that comes from that star in some sense bring us direct information about the star uncorrupted by the passage of time in the intervening space? Well, now that I've so thoroughly trashed reference frames, to answer this question, let me appeal to a reference frame. In our reference frame, the light that left the star was emitted long ago, 100 years ago, and a great distance, billions of kilometers away. But there's another reference frame, equally as valid as ours, according to special relativity, in which the light was emitted at a distance from us of only 1 centimeter, and it took only a tiny fraction of a second to reach us. So if you take this seriously, the answer is yes. In some sense, we're in very close causal contact with a star. In contrast, let's consider an event that happened in normal terms very close to us, say here on Earth, and only yesterday. An event like, for example, the fall of the government in Ottawa. Well, actually that didn't happen, but it almost happened. And it wasn't yesterday, but it was not so long ago. So an event like that, the elapsed proper time, as we say, between that event and us now, is immensely longer than the proper time between the emission of the photon at the star and the reception of the photon by us. The number of intervening events, in some sense, is much greater between what happened in Ottawa and us now in this meeting and the emission and absorption of the photon by the star. So this is what I was trying to indicate by this motto here, a star is closer than yesterday. And so that would be my answer, except for one final wrinkle, which I'd like to add, which is discrete space-time. So that already came up in one of the questions. Many of the people working on quantum gravity, and certainly many of the people at Perimeter, believe in one or another form of discrete space-time. If space-time were continuous and not discrete, then even if the photon were emitted very close to us and took only a short time to reach us, it still had to pass an infinite number of intermediates to get to us. Like Zeno's tortoise, it had to pass an infinite number of points of space-time to reach us. This is not so, however, if space-time were truly discrete. In that case, the photon would only have to pass a finite number of events. How many? Well, it could be as small as one, or in some cases, it could be even none. So in a theory of discrete space-time, or at least in some of them, an event in our eye is an immediate causal contact, immediate, with no intermediary, immediate causal contact with an event in a star. So when you look up at a star, having this in mind, it's not as if you could reach out and touch it. In some sense, you really are touching it. I like to think about that sometimes when stargazing. Maybe, in fact, it's one reason why the night sky is so beautiful to all of us. I guess there's no time for the second question, right?
No, I think we're out of time, but thank you very much. The next responder is also a long-term visitor who is equally esteemed and again represents the flexibility that we covet so dearly. Laurent Freidel comes to us from France, from Lyon, where he is a CNRS fellow, and he received his PhD at the École Normale Supérieure. The question that he will be responding to comes from Willie Gollinger, who is a high school student in Alma, Ontario. And unfortunately, Willie is unable to be here this evening, so I am stepping into the breach and reading his question for him. So please bear that in mind as I read the question, because there will be an obvious error right from the very beginning. The question goes, I am a high school student with a question that baffles my physics teacher. My teacher has made it quite clear that nothing can go the speed of light. He said that an object will approach a terminal velocity, and the energy added will be increasingly converted to mass as it approaches this velocity. According to Einstein's theory of gravity, a massive object will warp the curvature of space-time in towards it. So, picture a runner traveling close to the speed of light. More and more energy is put into his running, and since he's approaching terminal velocity, the energy is being converted to mass. The more massive he becomes, the more he warps the curvature of space. Would it then be possible that when the space warps in around the runner, a stride that would normally cover a few meters will now be larger by a factor of the warping of the space? In other words, would the space crunch down, allowing the runner to take a short step over a really long distance? Laurent.
Hi. So I'm sorry that the student is not here, and I understand that his physics teacher was baffled by the question, because there's a lot of things in the, a lot of physics in this question. So before answering directly to the question, I want to review some of the material contained in that question. So, as it, you know, as said correctly in the question, it's true that we know that no massive object can go faster than the speed of light, no matter how much energy I give this object. So this is represented here by this diagram, you know, where I plot the speed of a given object with respect to its energy. So at some point, if I'm close to the speed of light, is it working? Yeah. If I'm close to the speed of light, the amount of energy, if I give a certain amount of energy, the amount of increase of speed I will get from there will be smaller and smaller. So in that sense, the object seems to become more massive. More formally, if I go back to the famous equation that the energy is proportional to mc squared, strictly speaking, this is true. Usually this equation is presented when the object is supposed to be at rest. So when the object is at rest, the m that arises here is really the mass rest, which is the amount of stuff, the amount of matter that is contained in the object. Now, if I look at a moving object in special relativity, I will have also a relation that the energy is proportional to mass times c squared, but now the mass is dependent on the speed of the object, and there's a formula for it. The detail of the formula is not important. What's important is that this mass will, this speed-dependent mass will necessarily be bigger than the rest mass, and essentially this speed-dependent mass contains the rest mass and some kinetic energy that the object has. And this mass really acts as an initial mass. So in order to see that, I need to picture something where I take two objects, which are identical, except that one is called slow, so it goes at slow speed. The other one goes faster. And when they pass by me, I give them the same kick. Right, the same kick of momentum or the same kick of energy. What happens is that the object which is fast will see its velocity increase to a lesser extent than the object which is running slow. And the notion of inertial mass is defined at the amount of acceleration I gain when I apply a force to the system. So in that sense, it is true that a fast object is more massive. So the question is about how these things affect general relativity. If it's more massive, there will be more gravity. So first, before looking at moving objects, I want to recall two facts we know about general relativity. So first, if I have a mass which is at rest somewhere, so I try to picture a mass which is at rest here, the correct way to picture the effect of gravity due to this massive object is that it's going to warp space-time. So here it's just a representation of the fact that the space is warped, and a trajectory on this warped space will just be bended due to the warping of the space-time. The thing I can't picture there is that there will be also warping of time going on. So the time will go slower when the gravity is stronger. The second thing we know is that because of, in general relativity, the warping of space-time or gravity is not only due to mass or rest mass, but it's due to any form of energy. So any form of energy will create a gravitational potential or warping of space-time. This is due to a simple fact that as soon as you take into account special relativity and quantum mechanics, you necessarily have the fact that if you have a given object, which is a particle, let's say an electron, the corresponding antiparticle should be there. And if I imagine a situation where I, you know, start from having an electron and its anti-electron sitting there at rest, both have a given mass, and then I give them a small kick so that they punch into each other, then these two objects will just burst into and be converted into pure energy. So mass will be converted into pure energy. But the gravitational potential that they create should not disappear due to this process. So this tells us that gravity should couple not only to mass, but also more generally to energy. And to something, in fact, we call the energy momentum tensor. This strange name just reflects the fact that the coupling of gravity, in fact, depends on the motions of the objects, too. So if I try to picture out something which is now closer to the question, what happens if I take a moving object? And let me take an object which is, so instead of looking just at some object which is at rest like that, I now look at an object which is moving extremely fast. So let's say along this direction. And I take the limit where this object is moving at an extreme velocity, really close to the speed of light. What will happen is that, of course, along the direction of the motion, there will be a contraction of the object. And the object will look more and more like a pancake for an external observer. What will really happen from the point of view of gravity is that in this limit, the space-time will become shockwave space-time. This means that when I'm far away or before the object passed by me, then space-time looks like a flat space-time. And after the object has passed by me, the object still looks like a flat space-time. But of course, when the object is going on my side, I will feel quite dizzy, in fact. So here, I picture two things that will happen. So let's suppose I have two clocks, you know, which show three o'clock, which are there. And the object is moving along this direction. And then there is a shock wave, of gravity shock wave, which is perpendicular to its direction of motion. While it's moving along the clocks, it will pull the clock which is closer to it, you know, much more than the clock which is farther to it. So at first, the two clocks are at the same position. After the shock wave pass, one is just advance with respect to the other. What will happen, too, is that not only they will move in space, but they will also move in time. So even if the two clocks show the same time before, after, they are not going to show the same time. The one which is in the strongest gravitational field will move to a lesser extent than the one which is in a weaker gravitational field. So this one will advance with respect to this clock, even if they started at the same moment. So in that sense, it's clear that of course, the warping of space-time is affected by the motion of the observer. The problem is that here I'm talking only about one object moving in space-time, but this effect, I can annihilate this effect if I decide to be an observer which moves along with the object I'm looking at. So if I go at the same speed at this as this shock wave, then I will recover my usual black hole with a spherically symmetric potential. So in order to really see the warping of space-time now, I need to look at, for instance, two of these objects which are really boosted at high speed and send one against the other. If the impact parameter, by that I mean the distance between these two shock waves, is small enough and the energy is high enough, what will happen is that this object will not. So if the impact parameter is big, these two objects will be deflected. But if the parameter is small, at some point a black hole will form and gravitational radiation will be emitted. So in that sense, it's really the contrary of what was the effect that the question looked for, you know, to speed up the process. If a black hole forms, this object is completely stopped, put to rest. It cannot escape to infinity. If I go to a more realistic situation, I have to picture out how I will accelerate an object in a strong gravitational field. And the simplest situation of that case would be when I look at a star, a neutron star or a regular star, which is accelerated by a very massive object, let's say a black hole. And what will happen is that if I have a black hole there, a star moving, it will be, you know, strongly accelerated by the gravitational field of the black hole, and it will emit gravitational waves. And gravitational waves are really warping of space-time, and they are really a type of warping of space-time due to moving or accelerated source that people try to detect in objects like LIGO. So I have a motion, I have a movie such object moving very, very, very fast. The object that will really create, maybe, yeah, thank you. Okay. So the object that will really create strong gravitational wave will be binary pulsars, but I can't show you a picture of that. I can show you a picture of something which is very beautiful, I think. This is a picture of the center of our galaxy. And it's a movie which has taken people more than 10 years to be taken, and it lasts 10 minutes. You're going to, it lasts just, 1 minute. And it's quite representative to what we do in research, right? You work for 10 years on a problem, and maybe if you're lucky, you understand it, and when you understand it, you can explain it in, you know, half an hour, 10 minutes. And that's it. So the time scale here is well represented. So we're looking at the center of the galaxy, and we're looking at stars moving around the center of the galaxy there. And the motion of the stars are due to a very massive object, which is about 3 million times the solar mass of 3 million times the mass of our sun, and presumably it's a black hole, a huge massive black hole. So you can see here on the left hand side the date. So we're closing up. So this is the center of galaxy. Then we're closing up there, and we see this amazingly fast motion. So the stars there, they are speed up about a few percent of the speed of light. So they go at like 3,000 kilometers per second. And let's go. And if you go to date, we start in 1992 and we end up in 2005, right? And that's a clear signature of this huge black hole. And of course, gravitational wave will be emitted there, but the one emitted there will be very, very hard to detect because gravity is very weak. To end up the question, so far I've said, and because objects which are moving fast emit gravitational wave, they will slow down. So there's no way in which I can realize what the question was looking for, right? So as the person say, I want to say he's off his rocker, but not totally, in fact, because I have one example where which shows that he's not totally off his rocker, which is the fact that there is a solution, which is a mathematical solution of our equations, which are Einstein equations, which exactly does what the high school student, the question wanted to do, that is have a space-time that kind of speed up itself. It's called a warp drive space-time, right? It's a mathematical solution for our equations, but it's a totally unphysical one. So the warp drive space-time can be constructed, you can take a kind of shell of matter where the geometry inside is just flat. And if you go really at infinity, the geometry is also flat. And the geometry is such that in front, so the object is moving in this direction, and in front of the object, the space and space-time is contracted. Behind the object, the space is expanding. So the bubble, which is there, is moving, and it can move as fast as you can, view from the point of view of infinity. Of course, locally, nothing can move faster than the speed of light. But viewed from these guys, it can look like this bubble in which you can things to put a spaceship, you know, is moving faster than the speed of light. So, but there's a catch. The catch is that in order to do that, I have to create this bubble by using a shell of matter. And the matter I have to use there is an exotic type of matter, which do not exist. It's an exotic type of matter that violates the positive energy condition. And it's not a physical type of matter. So that's where, you know, we can draw the line between physics and mathematics. Some things are allowed in mathematics that are not allowed in physics. And the answer, I mean, the final answer is that nothing is for free in physics. Thank you.
Just for those of you who are curious to know, in theoretical physics circles, the phrase "not totally off his rocker" is actually a compliment, by the way. we move on without any further ado to the next question. The question comes from Colin Clark of Kitchener.
And my question is there a viable string theory explanation of quantum entanglement?
Okay, thank you for that question. It's kind of an interdisciplinary question, which is all covered at PI, but I only can cover somehow one part, but I'll try to cover the other part as well. So, there are two parts to the question. First, quantum entanglement, and the other one is connected to string theory. So let me first try to explain quantum entanglement. And probably Joe could have done that much better than I, but let me try anyways. So there's a standard example for quantum entanglement, which is one takes some particle which is at rest, and it's some unstable particle which will decay eventually, and it's not rotating, it doesn't have any spin. And eventually it will decay into two particles, and both of them will have a spin. That means they are rotating. And because of angular momentum conservation, they will be rotating in opposite directions, at least classically. For each of the two particles, the axis of rotation is not known. It could rotate in that direction, around that axis, or around that axis, or so. That's not known from the beginning of the problem. And what one can do is one can measure how particle one, the one that's moving, let's say, in that direction, is rotating with respect to a certain axis which is given. And then ask, what can we say about the rotation of the second particle? So we can ask, what can be predicted about a measurement of the rotation of particle two around another given axis? And let me first tell you something about the rotation of particles in some quantum theory. And basically, one can pick an axis and measure how much it rotates around that direction. And classically, one could say it can rotate in all possible velocities around that direction. But in quantum theory, actually, it can either rotate with some strength one along the axis, or it will rotate in the opposite direction with strength 1, but it will not rotate with strength 0.5 or something like that. And now, if the axis for the measurement of the two rotations are aligned for the two particles, so let me pick that axis here, and then one of the particles will rotate along that axis with a after the measurement, and the second particle will rotate in the opposite direction. And if I know how the first particle rotates, I know exactly in which way the other particle rotates. However, if the axes are not aligned, let's say one axis goes in that direction, one axis goes in that direction, then knowing how the one particle rotates doesn't really tell me how the other particle rotates. It will either rotate with strength one in that direction or with strength one around that axis. And there's some correlation between what I measure for the first particle and what I measure with the second particle. And actually, it turns out that that correlation cannot be explained classically, but only in some... it's a completely quantum mechanical result. Now, that was the stuff that I don't know all that well. Well, I still know it, but not, I'm not an expert. But now let me explain what string theory is to answer at the end the question that was asked. So let me first give the official advertisement for string theory. It basically solves all the problems of the world. So there's Einstein's theory of gravity. Then we know that there's quantum mechanics and there's elementary particle physics. And string theory claims it can unify all of them and be a single theory which describes everything. It's a theory of everything. And this especially allows to do physics under extreme conditions. We can, in principle, try to understand how Big Bang and cosmology works, how black holes work, or we can collide particles at extremely high energies. And to give you a feeling about those energies, that energy is called Planck energy. And basically, in order to do such a collider experiment, we have to put as much energy in a single electron as we need to shoot a cow to the moon. Or alternatively, if you're into diet and so on, it's basically worth half a year of an adult diet in terms of calories. And that has to go all in one electron, and then we need a second electron which does the same thing, and we collide them head on. So that's not really possible, but anyways, it's interesting to ask a question what happens. Now, that was the official advertisement. Now there's a caveat to it. We don't really understand what string theory is as a full theory yet. It's some kind of approximation schemes, and we know how to calculate lots of things, but we don't quite understand it yet. And especially, we can't really calculate realistic situations. So we don't, we can build our toy world, and that works pretty well, but it doesn't work for the real world yet. So now let me explain the basic idea. So we replace point-like particles. So we thought electrons are points, but now we say that if we look under a big microscope at those electrons, they are actually strings. They are like rubber bands, and they are vibrating. And they can vibrate in different frequencies and modes. And the interesting thing is, basically, those different vibrational modes can be identified as different particles in the theory. So an electron would be a string hardly vibrating, and maybe a proton would be a string wildly vibrating or in different ways and so on. And some interesting fact that was observed is that some of those string states actually correspond to gravitons, which are excitations of gravity. So it includes general relativity. And on the other hand, we find lots of string states which look very similar to particles we find, like electrons, protons, or photons, and all of that. So it looks like it has a potential to have all kinds of physics that we know in it. Now let me summarize some facts about that theory. So on top of strings, there are also other objects in the theory, which we call brains. So it looks more or less like a membrane. So it's like maybe a flat piece of paper, and strings can end on it. So if my finger is a string, it can end on there and move along there. So those are called deep brains, and there are lots of other complicated objects in there, but that's one of the most prominent ones. And another fact is that string theory lives in 10 dimensions. So it has one time direction and 9 space directions. We here have only 3 space directions, so there are 6 too many, and we need to do something with that. And basically, we need to roll them up. So the cartoon that I drew here is one can take a piece of paper and roll it up about like that. And if there's a little bug walking on that piece of paper, it looks like a two-dimensional world. It can move in two directions. But if I roll it up smaller, one direction will almost disappear. That direction gets smaller, and at some point it will just look like a like one dimension. It can only go basically in that direction or that direction. I cannot really go around the sheet of paper. So that's what we do with 6 of those dimensions, and we're left with 3 space-like and 1 time-like. So that's how we construct our real world. And those strings then interact by joining and splitting. So one can see that I drew the time direction upwards, and there's a string 1 and a string 2 coming in, and they join, and then they split again, and there are 2 different strings coming out. That's how we calculate there. And well, that was a lightning review of string theory. I hope I can give you exams soon on that. And now entanglement in string theory. Well, first, string theory is formulated in the framework of quantum mechanics. It's a quantum theory. For this reason, it has quantum entanglement. That's great. However, it cannot explain quantum entanglement because that's put in by hand from the beginning. However, it allows to test and play around with entanglement in under extreme conditions. So what I had first was one particle sitting around here and decaying and 2 particles flying apart. Now you can do that next to a black hole and have one particle fly into the black hole and maybe try to learn something about what's happening inside the black hole by looking at what you measure outside. Or you could play around with some cosmological scenarios where you have several parallel universes and you could try to entangle states in different universes. So you know that if I measure something here, then you have a certain probability distribution for measuring stuff in the other universe. So if my old cousin lives over there, then I know what he measures. However, I don't know exactly how much was played around with that yet. So it's definitely problems to play around with. The black hole stuff is more explored, and people are really interested in that. Now, to conclude, let me just give some other big open problems in string theory. So the first one I already said, what is string theory really? We kind of have some pictures, and we can calculate things in certain limits, but we don't really know what it is. Then the second one is understand gravity. Since it includes gravity and quantum mechanics, it would help us to understand quantum gravity under some extreme conditions, like black holes, that would actually relate to the question that you asked. And then there's a quite different set of questions, which is, if it's a theory of everything, we should be able to derive lots of properties of this world. We should maybe be able to derive the mass of the electron or something like that, or do some predictions. And in 2007, some new big accelerator is going online, and hopefully by 2008 it will provide some data, and maybe we can learn something about string theory or predict something with string theory which we can test there. It's not really clear. So as you see, there's still a lot of work for us to do at PI and also in other places.
Our final question will be addressed by Cliff Burgess. His question will be read by Don Keith of Waterloo. Don.
I also have a question that's much less down to earth. It has to do with a formula devised by an American astrophysicist in 1961 to calculate the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy that support intelligent and technologically advanced life that we could conceivably get in touch with. He applied some assumptions of probabilities to this and to this formula, and he came up with 1 million stars in the Milky Way galaxy that could support intelligent life. I think astronomers have taken a much more pessimistic view since then, but his optimism, I think, inspired the search for intelligent life project down in Puerto Rico and the very large radio telescope down there. And I'm interested in knowing whether you have any number less or more optimistic than that 1 million stars.
Okay, thank you. That's a great question. What's great about this is actually before I start, there's a number of things about this question that are great, because they cut to the core of why it's fun to be a theoretical physicist. One is, you know, who's not interested in extraterrestrial life? That's great. But the second thing is that the question is about the Drake equation, which is an equation that's a tool in searches for extraterrestrial life. And what's nice about the Drake equation, which I'll tell you more about in a sec, is that the whole subject of searching for extraterrestrial life is very speculative, and we like to speculate, as you've seen. But what's great about theoretical physics is that you also like to bridle that speculation with mathematics and compare it to observations. And the Drake equation and the search for extraterrestrial life, I hope you'll be convinced when I finished, really is an example of that. That when, you know, 30 years or more have passed since he wrote this equation down, and in many, when I told you I don't know the answer, it's true. I could say 42 is my number, but you can have your own number. But the Drake equation brings out what you need to know to answer the question, and it also brings out the progress that's been made since Drake made this equation up. And we know a lot more now than we did then, and I'm old enough to know that the things I learned when I was a kid are different than the things that my kids are learning now. So SETI is the acronym for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and it's people with radio telescopes looking for signals from space. You know, we've been sending signals to space for a long time. You know, I Love Lucy episodes are out there, and the aliens are watching them. And we're sending signals also, this is a composite picture of the Earth at night, and we're just sending signals that's just light that's leaking from our cities. And so there's signals out there, if there are civilizations like ours out there, and it's not. The question is it crazy to look for that? Are civilizations so rare that you'll never see one, it's a needle in the haystack? Or are there civilizations all over the place and we should really be looking for their I Love Lucy episodes coming towards us? Now, you want to use signals like that rather than just looking with a telescope because space is big. This is a picture, this is actually quite a cool picture. The one on the left is a photograph of the Earth taken from Mars, from one of the space probes that was sent to Mars. The thing on the right is just kind of a cartoon showing you what you're looking at. So you're, you know, South America is in the foreground and North America is at the top. And that tells you, you know, Mars isn't so far away on the scale of space, and you wouldn't know that there was life on the Earth looking at that picture. You wouldn't see the seasons change appreciably. It's a difficult business because space is so large. So you want to look for electromagnetic signals, like with radio telescopes, and you want to look for signs of intelligence in them. So what did Drake do? So he wrote this equation down. Here's his equation. So I want to walk you through this equation just a little bit, because that's going to tell you something about what we've learned. So the equation's not such a big deal. What you're looking for is how many planets are there out there, how many civilizations are there out there like us broadcasting that we could be looking for. That's N, is the number of those things. And so what Drake says is that you can think of that as being a product of a bunch of things that we could hope to learn. And so what are those things? I'm going to go left to right here. So the first thing is he's working within the framework that these civilizations are going to be not so different from us because we're the only life that we know about. We're going to think that you need to have some Earth-like planet with liquid water, and that probably means we're on a sun-like star, and the planet's orbiting a sun-like star. So one thing you want to know is how many of those stars are out there. And so he phrases that in terms of the rate at which these stars are formed. And so that's what our star is. It's the rate at which stars like the sun are formed in our galaxy. He wants to multiply that number by the fraction of those stars that have planets, which is what he's calling F here. So that's something between 0 and 1. If it's 1, they all have planets. If it's 0, none of them have planets. He wants to multiply that. Given you've got a solar system, how many of the planets are suitable for life, Earth-like? Are they, you know, in a region where you could have liquid water? So that's what little n is. Then we're going to multiply by the fraction. So now you've got a habitable planet. What fraction of those things does life actually arise on? How rare is life? Two theories are out there. One is that as soon as you get a planet that could work, then life's there as soon as it's like cockroaches. They're all over the place as soon as you've got a place to put them. And the other theory is it's really a rare event. And so it normally doesn't happen, but there's a whole raft of planets out there, so eventually it happens somewhere, and then that's, you know, why we're here, let's say. And then in that picture, F would be much smaller, and so it would be much more less likely to find things out there. Given you got life, you have to then ask for intelligent life. So something which is going to actually send, you know, make and send I Love Lucy episodes to you. So how likely is that? And then the last thing is that they have to choose to send those signals, and they have to be, you know, able to send those signals. Just because they're intelligent, you know, they could be fish or something, but intelligent fish, maybe they can't send these signals. And the last thing is they have to live a while. So if they're around and then they kill themselves off after a couple of years, then they're not going to be on average for many of them to see. So those are the things you need to know. And so what does that tell you? One of the things it tells you is kind of a fundamental theorem of theoretical physics. Just because you can write an equation down doesn't mean you know anything. And so here's an equation, and you don't necessarily know anything. But it's not a pointless exercise, because it focuses what you would need to know if you wanted to figure something out. So you can now think in a more focused way, you know, what do we know about how often stars form, or how likely is it that we get life, and what kind of evidence would we need to convince ourselves that these numbers are whatever they might be. And that's where the progress has been. So that's, I want to take you through some of those things now. So the first thing we actually know quite a bit about, you know, our star has been around for a long time, but you see a lot of stars and you can see them forming. We understand stars very well. In our galaxy, there's something like 100 billion stars. They each live for about 10 billion years. So on average, if the total number is not changing much, you're getting about 10 form per year. That's kind of what our star would be. So that's something which Drake knew too. It's something which people have known for a long time, how many stars there are and how fast they form. This is actually a movie, which you probably can't see. So let me just broadcast it. I'll just put it for a second here, so that should be okay. Can you see that? I just mostly got this because it's cool. This is not an artist's conception. This is a film of the sun taken from we got satellites watching the sun 24/7. And this is a film of the satellites, of the sun taken from those satellites, and that thing in front of it is Mercury passing by in front of the sun. So that's really kind of cool. That happens every once in a while, and that's one of the ways you can look for planets. So the next question is how many planets, stars have planets? And this is one of the exciting things, is that we actually know of more about that than we used to know. So, you know, 10 years ago, no one had ever found a planet not going around our sun, but now, more than 130-odd planets are known orbiting other stars. And that's something which has happened very recently. And so it seems to be now that we can survey some stars near us, that it's stars are, you know, planets are like dirt, that every star has one, or maybe several, and it's not very rare that you have planets. And Drake had no idea what this number was, and here's an example of progress, that we can really now, with reasonable confidence, say that this factor is probably close to one, because planets seem to be really generic to stars. Now, the bad news is, almost all of those planets, or a good number of them, aren't Earth-like. They're more like Jupiter, and a good many of them are not as far away from their star as Jupiter is from our sun. Many of them are really up close to, they're closer to their sun than Mercury is to our sun, although they're as big as Jupiter. Those are not planets you're going to find life on, in all likelihood, if life is like ours. So of the 130-odd planets, you know, one of them is the size of the Earth and it kind of in the right position relative to the sun to have water, and we're living on that one. So right now the number here is something like 1 in 100 is about the number of Earth-like planets. But what we don't really know yet, but which we should know in the near future, is how generic that is. Because the way people look for planets around other stars is better at finding big ones than finding small ones. And it's better at finding them the planets that are close to their stars than it is for finding ones that are farther away. So there's kind of a bias involved in the search, that we're systematically finding the ones that are bigger and closer. So it may be that this number is wrong, but this is kind of what you'd go on if based on what we know now. How likely is it that life starts once a planet's there to have it start on? Interestingly enough, you can say something about that. And one way, you know, we only have one planet on which we know life started. But what you can ask is, you know, when did life start on the Earth? If it was such a rare thing to happen, you'd expect that probably on Earth it wouldn't start very soon after the Earth started. But if it's something which happens very frequently, then it's probably true. You're going to find, as soon as you can find evidence of life, you'll find it. Now, when can you start finding evidence for life? The early solar system, about more than 4 billion years ago, was a violent place. You know, all the stars and all the planets and moons that you see typically are riddled with craters. That's because the whole solar system was full of things. They were all bumping into each other and colliding, and so there was a lot of damage going on. That's where the moon came from, as an example. There was a lot of big collisions happening, and to the Earth in particular. And so the surface of the Earth wouldn't have had rocks on it until quite late in the day, and that late in the day was about 4 billion years ago. So if you're going to see evidence of, you know, fossil evidence of anything, it's going to have to be after 4 billion years ago. Now, it happens that the first evidence that there was life on Earth goes back to 3.8 billion years ago. So almost immediately after, on the scale of how long the Earth is, you could have had evidence for life. You find evidence for life. That evidence isn't fossils. It's in the isotopic abundance of carbon that you find in gas pockets and things in very old rocks. And it's evidence that photosynthesis was happening. And it happening enough that it was changing the chemistry of the air on the global basis so that it would have been around for a while. And so it seems to be on Earth, and this is again something which wasn't known, I don't think, in Drake's day, but that life happened on Earth pretty much as fast as it could have happened. And that makes it optimistic that probably you find planets that are habitable. You'll either find life or you'll find fossils of life, that they probably, it's just not such a long shot that they would have had life on them. Now, those are the things we know a lot about, or more about than he did. There's still things that we have no clue on. One is, you know, why should life lead to intelligence? There's no evidence at all that evolution favors intelligence. It favors intelligence maybe now, that we're all the world is full of people, and it's better to be smart than it is to be dumb, given that you're surrounded by people. But if you were a single-celled organism and you had been the first thing that was alive on a planet, there's no evidence that you'd be preferred to be taken in a direction towards intelligence, which sounds contradictory. Complexity, you might think, is the natural process of evolution because, you know, we've got horses and cows and people now, and you didn't have that 3 billion years ago. But really, the appearance of complexity is consistent, so far as we know, with just the fact that when life starts, it starts simple. And then if it randomly starts to change, it can't get much more simpler, but it can get more complicated, so on average it gets more complicated. But there's no evidence there. There may be a selection for intelligence starting from first principles, but there's no evidence for that yet. So that the betting man would have to say that there's really, it's up for grabs how likely intelligence is to be produced once you have life produced. So no one really knows what this is, so you can make up your favorite number here. Another thing is, given that you have maybe the most intelligent civilizations don't send us their I Love Lucy episodes, you know, and it's not because they're embarrassed, it's because they're worried. You know, we have evidence on the Earth, and you can ask this in a scientific way. On Earth, there's been more than one case when a civilization has met another civilization for the first time, and by and large, that's not a good thing for one of those two civilizations. You know, there's a list of some of this. You know, this happened for Neanderthals and Homo sapiens in Europe. It happened when the Europeans colonized the Americas and Australia. It happened when the Bantus moved to South Africa and displaced the Aborigines. It happened when the Polynesians came across from Taiwan. You know, many times in the Earth's history, there's been movements of civilizations where one finds the other. And typically, one dies out or is dramatically depopulated, largely because of disease, if not for other reasons, more overt reasons. And so if you find ET in your backyard, that may not be the best thing that's going to happen to us, because we may. If you're the person who's not doing the traveling, you're probably the one that's going to be worse off in the exchange. And then there's other things. You know, the whole Drake equation assumes that we have to be on an Earth-like planet. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe you can have life in other forms. And so that's the whole framework of the equation might be up for grabs. So I get invited to speculate, and I gave you my number. It was 42 because I like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But really, there are some things you can say about, I think, extraterrestrial life, which are you can defend, at least in a scientific way, although it's something which is, of course, speculative until you find examples of extraterrestrial life. So the ones that are easiest to say are the things that you think that life will not be like. So here's my list of what things will not be like when we meet aliens. They will not be vaguely human-shaped. They will not be watching us with UFOs. They will not be kept secret by the US government in Area 51. They will not probably be cute like ET. Things like that, I think, are probably pretty much no-brainers, although Hollywood seems to miss that. But you can say things about what life is probably likely to be. So if I had to bet money, this is my bet, that if you find life off of the Earth, it's probably going to be single-celled life, largely because that's the least complicated thing. That's what forms first, and that's the most abundant thing at some level on the Earth. But that's not going to be probably intelligent. That's probably going to be just, you know, flu virus or something. But if you find extraterrestrial intelligent life, there's some other things you can probably say, which basically come down to the observation that they're multicellular. And these things, I don't have time to defend, but if someone asks, I can defend why I think these things are true. If things are multicellular, then they probably are sexually reproducing, they're probably mortal, and they're probably dangerous. And those things are based on, the arguments for that are based on why it's true that sexual reproduction is so common amongst things that are living on Earth. You can ask, why should that be true? Given, for instance, that cloning would be a much better way to get into the next generation. And the arguments for sexual reproduction probably apply in general, not just to life here. So when I teach this course on astronomy for poets in McGill and at McMaster, I tell the kids the first day that I'm going to tell them why aliens have sex. And that normally packs the house. So let me finish with a caveat emptor. If you're looking for life, you can get fooled because your brain is trained to find kinds of life. And the face on Mars was the famous one. Some people thought that you're seeing examples of civilizations on Mars, when a closer look told you that it was just a bad picture of a mountain, and in your mind is designed, your brain is hardwired to find faces, because that was evolutionary, a good thing from the point of view of evolution as people evolved. So with that caveat in mind, I hope that you see that there's been progress made, and we know more about whether or not there could be life, although we still don't know anywhere near as much as we'd need to know what the number n should have been in Drake's equation. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Cliff, I'm sure that everyone get a very good sense of the breadth and intellectual acuity of Cliff, and in fact, all of our researchers here. And speaking personally, that was the first time I have ever heard the equivalence postulated between intelligent life and I Love Lucy episodes. So I've learned something, as well as all the rest of us, of course, this evening. Unfortunately, we are running a little bit over time. We do not have time for questions from the audience, but at this time I would like to thank not only all of our respondents, but all of our questioners for a very successful and lively and informative evening. Thank you all very much.